The English public school is a peculiarly Victorian institution. We join Mark Worden now to see how such schools are facing up to the late 20th century.
In April 1991, a British businessman called Roger Cooper was released from an Iranian prison after having served a 5-year sentence for espionage. Asked how he'd survived the ordeal, Mr. Cooper replied, "Anyone who, like me, has been educated in an English public school and served in the ranks of the British Army is quite at home in a third world prison." Britain's public schools have been described as one of the most extraordinary institutions in the world. They were designed for the sons of the upper and middle classes who had board at them from the ages of 13 to 18. Most of the pupils had in fact been sent away from home at the age of 8 to even more unusual places known as preparatory or prep schools. The term public school is of course a misnomer, for these institutions are strictly private. Although many of these schools are medieval foundations, the modern public school is a Victorian phenomenon. Its heyday coincided with that of the British Empire. Although the fees were costly, the living conditions were deliberately Spartan, the idea being that this experience would prepare young men for the hardship of the colonies. George Orwell was a typical product of this system. He left Eton in 1921 to become an officer in the Imperial Indian Police. He is best known for the novel 1984, which offered a hideous vision of a totalitarian future. Yet according to some critics, many of the book's more repulsive details, such as the prison cell with an open toilet, were inspired by Orwell's memories of boarding school life. The British Empire was dismantled after the Second World War, but the public schools lived on. Many of their more disturbing customs survived until the 1960s. One of the most controversial was the administering of corporal punishment, which was the prerogative of senior boys or prefects, rather than the masters, whose authority was limited to the classroom and the games field. Basil Morgan describes Uppingham, the school where the author of this article spent his formative years, in the relatively civilized 1970s.
The old fathers of people who were here then say that, houses that did barbaric rituals, whereby if somebody's going to be beaten, they'd wait till the dormitory had gone to bed, and then there'd be a banging of the pipes down in the changing rooms, which would echo all around the house, and this meant that somebody, somewhere, was about to be called to be beaten. And, apparently there are gripping stories of suddenly a noise up the stairs and the dormitory door would be thrown open, you see, and Jones! And he had to go down, and beaten he was. Always in the changing room, always at night.
Another characteristic of the Spartan lifestyle was the obsession with sport. In most public schools, athletic excellence was valued above that of an academic nature. It is no coincidence that that most manly of sports, rugby, was named after the public school at which it was invented. Although these sports were originally encouraged as a means of suppressing lust in an all-male community, they also became an integral part of the character-building process. In England, it is generally believed that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton.
There is an element of enjoying being Spartan, I think. And I think it may be something particularly to do with the British character, I don't know. I think we do basically enjoy that sort of thing. I mean, why otherwise do we produce all these mountaineers and explorers and to be the first up Everest or whatever it might be? I mean, we enjoy it, I'm sure. The other thing, I think, is, when Belk used to be asked, remember Belk? Used to be asked what the main advantage of boarding school education was. He always used to say it was to get them away from their mothers.
It has often been observed that the public schools have played a large part in moulding the British character. The classic reserve and inability to express emotion, as well as the stiff upper lip, are all thought to be the natural outcome of spending one's teens in a climate where privacy was non-existent. It cannot be denied, however, that this tough education system has softened up in recent decades. Mothers, for example, are no longer left out of the picture. Instead, they are seen as important clients by schools eager to market a product that can cost up to £11,000 a year. Marketing requirements may also explain the most radical change to have hit boarding schools in the last 20 years. The arrival of female pupils. This is bound to have revolutionary effects on the public school boys themselves, who who have traditionally felt uncomfortable in the presence of women. It has, for example, been argued that the conquest of the Conservative Party by Gross's daughter Margaret Thatcher was due to her similarity to Nanny and Matron, the main female figures in an English aristocrat's childhood. But what is the masculine world of the public school like for the girls themselves? We asked Rebecca Castle how Uppingham compared with her previous school.
The teaching, I think, is of a higher standard. I don't think the standard of the pupils is higher than you would find in a state school, but I think the teaching is overall better. From my experience, I would say that, because I have been in the state system before I went to boarding school. The advantage of being in a mixed education, in a boarding school, you have to toughen up, you have to face a lot of things like organising yourself and becoming independent. And although we do have all these opportunities, they're not just laid down on a plate for us. You know, you have got to organise yourself and motivate yourself.
Yet even in these changing times, some things remained the same. According to 18-year-old Robert Winter, captain of the school at Uppingham, sport still plays a dominant role in boarding school life.
Well, I'm quite sporty myself, as you've probably guessed, but I think it plays such a big part in everybody's lives. I mean, everybody goes out 3 times a week at least to play sport at whatever level, whether they're a team player or just do it for the exercise. So it's a big part of everyone's lives. And, you know, on Saturdays when the first 15 are playing, if you're not doing something, you go up and watch, and that's just how it is. So it's quite high profile. And I think it's part of the education, really, because sport, again, broadens the mind, really. If you can play a good team sport, then what it does for you as a person is really sort of amazing, I think.
I think it's true that probably a lot of the silly things have gone. Of course, it is still possible to find corporal punishment in some of these schools, which has, again, for long been thought to be part of the English disease, beating children. Although that's not common nowadays, it still exists and is certainly legally still acceptable. And I suppose one might still find hierarchical rules, often perhaps imposed by the boys themselves, who, as I said earlier, are often the most cruel and traditional people. If you are a new pupil, all the buttons of your jacket must be done up, and a year later you may undo one of them, but the others must be, and so on. Or there may be a hierarchy of ties, for instance, that all boys in the school wear a basic school tie, but if they have distinguished themselves in a particular way, especially in games, they may have a special striped tie, or one which, as we would say, a colours tie, which distinguishes them as more superior to their contemporaries, perhaps, because more muscle-bound or skillful in these particular areas. All these things perhaps are in retreat, but they still exist and help to maintain a hierarchy which is perhaps natural to the pecking order of people growing up, but which is sometimes not discouraged by the school itself.
The most important tie, however, is the one boys and now girls receive when they leave the school. Although only about 7% of the population are educated in the so-called independent sector, it has always been the most privileged 7%. Englishmen who have been to the same school are notorious for helping each other in their careers. The term old school tie has become a byword for this almost Masonic network of contacts, which has traditionally dominated British public life. This much is apparent from the educational backgrounds of Britain's prime ministers. Since the Eton-educated Sir Robert Walpole took office in 1721, the country has had 50 prime ministers, of which roughly 70% were educated at public school. If this is a valid measurement, then the public schools are now declining in importance. The last public school educated Prime Minister, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, the 17th Etonian to hold the position, resigned in 1964. Nevertheless, the Old Boy network is still going strong, particularly in the armed forces in the city.
Now, why is this? Well, of course, it is connections. It's the Old Boy network. But it is, of course, natural if you've been at school with someone whom you know very well and you know his merits and demerits and whether he's someone you can trust or whether you know something about intellectual ability and so on. Or you may have then gone on to university with him and so on. So it's not necessarily a deplorable system, but we've certainly got it extensively with us still. Which isn't quite fair, is it?